Here Be Monsters is a show that invites you to explore fear and the unknown.
I saw her face change. I saw her see where I'd pulled my hair out.
Psychological warfare was always considered kind of an oddity, something done by freaks.
On the count of three, we're literally going to step out of our body. Step out.
You can find the new season of Here Be Monsters on August 17th at kcrw.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Frances Anderton, and this is DNA. Ben Medanski's downtown LA ceramic studio was destroyed by fire, but out of the ashes came something quite unexpected.
You know, I walked into the studio the next day and I turned on my Facebook Live video. I didn't realize that 15,000 people are going to be watching this thing right away. I started getting calls from around the world of people hearing of this and reaching out to see if I needed any support.
That's Ben Medanski. Hear from him later in the show. Do you feel like it's hard to resist buying stuff in Whole Foods? Could that be a case of seduction by design? We'll talk to the woman who's disrupting the supermarket experience. Before we get to that, though, another disruptor, this one in the automotive and energy worlds. Elon Musk is CEO of Tesla Motors, and whenever things seem to look bad for him, he doubles down on his plans. Amid a flurry of reports about a Tesla driver killed in a crash while using autopilot and slower than expected delivery of cars, he announced his so-called Master Plan Part Deux. And he invited journalists to check out his new Gigafactory for electric batteries currently under construction in Nevada. One of those journalists was Tim Stevens. He's editor-in-chief of Roadshow, CNET's auto destination site.
The Gigafactory is a pretty remarkable place. It is a massive factory in the middle of the desert, about a half an hour outside of Reno, Nevada, where Tesla and Panasonic are teaming up to build more batteries out of this one building in 1 year than the entire world produced in 2013, which is pretty remarkable. Tesla owns the building, and then they're basically leasing part of the inside to Panasonic. And Panasonic will be making battery cells that are about the size of a D-cell battery. And then Tesla will take those cells from Panasonic within the factory and bundle them together to create the battery packs that go into their cars. And they'll be producing at least 500,000 battery packs every year. They think they might even be able to do three times that with some efficiencies that they're looking at. And to do that, they've created this massive factory in the desert. It's right now 800,000 square feet, which is already mammoth, but it's going to be more than five times bigger than that, over 5 million square feet by the time they're done with the place, which should be sometime within the next couple of years.
Assuming they reach these numbers that you've just described, does that mean there can be a drop in the price of a Tesla car? Because it's the batteries that are the big expenditure.
The goal of this is definitely to drop the price of batteries. Right now, the batteries are largely produced in Asia and then shipped over to Tesla's Fremont, California facility, which is a pretty expensive thing. But also by absolutely dialing up the production of these and going to super mass production, Elon Musk thinks they can drop the cost of the overall battery packs by more than 30%, which is really significant. The battery pack in an EV is somewhere between 30 and 50% of the cost of the car. So that'll mean a significant cost savings. And as Tesla is looking to release the Model 3 soon, which is a much cheaper car than the Model S and the Model X they produce today, they absolutely need to save costs wherever they can. And this will be a big part of that.
So will these battery packs be available to other car companies or exclusively for Tesla?
Right now, the plan is exclusively for these batteries to be used by Tesla. Tesla is not just using them for their cars, though. They are actually producing battery packs for their Powerwall facilities, which is basically residential and industrial power systems that can basically fill in gaps when the power goes out or offset a solar system, that kind of thing.
Now, you needed a lot of air conditioning in a place in the middle of Reno. How's that taken care of? Presumably, the factory incorporates some energy-efficient means to do that.
Actually, having low humidity is a very important thing when you are producing batteries. They need to have very, very low amounts of water in the air. So having it in the middle of the desert helps there as well. And that basically will save them money in terms of having to scrub all the water out of the air. But definitely there will be some air conditioning involved because it gets very, very hot out there. And what Tesla wants to do is cover the entire roof with solar panels. And the goal is for the Gigafactory to be completely self-sufficient when it comes to power, which is pretty spectacular given the amount of power that it takes to produce these cells and, of course, to charge them as well.
So I think it's fair to say that Elon Musk doesn't do anything small. This tour that you went on of this gigafactory, it coincided with Musk making a very public presentation of this so-called master plan part deux. And that incorporated a concept that got at least Wall Street quite upset, and that was the proposed merger of SolarCity and Tesla, both companies that Elon Musk chairs. SolarCity is helmed by his cousin. So tell us about this master plan part deux.
Tesla definitely is always looking down the road. Elon Musk in particular is definitely looking down the road as far as he can. And so while we were standing in Nevada looking at this construction of this factory that still has a long way to go before it's completed, Musk was announcing effectively what he wants to do for effectively the next, you could say, 5 to 10 years, if not even beyond that, for Tesla with his part due master plan. And the first thing is really talking about the combination with SolarCity to create a single entity that effectively talks about all aspects of battery energy storage within your life, effectively. So not just cars, not just buildings, not just solar panels, and having separate companies to work with, but having effectively one sort of system that ties it all together. So not only do you have a solar panel on your roof, but you have that power being directed into a battery that's mounted on the wall of your garage, perhaps. And then that power can then be directed into your house as you need to offset high energy loads during hot days, for example, to power your AC, or it could be used to power your car, for example. So you could charge up that battery when the EV rates are low and then use that battery to then charge up your car later and have that all basically managed in one sort of a holistic system, which really isn't that different from if you look back at what Steve Jobs wanted to do with Apple and kind of create this holistic environment for your digital life. Elon Musk kind of wants to do the same thing, but take you into the more physical world. The next step of his master plan part two is more autonomy. There's been a lot of controversy with the autopilot system within Tesla and with the supplier that provides autopilot basically saying that we're not going to work with Tesla anymore because we're not really happy with the way that Tesla is using our technology. So Tesla is forging ahead and saying that they're going to basically develop their own autonomous software going forward. And in the shareholder call that Tesla just had, Elon Musk said that the autonomous software that they're working on, the functionality, has blown his mind. He thinks it's absolutely going to blow all of us away when we get to see it. He didn't tell us when we will get to see it. But he says it's absolutely incredible the things that Tesla is working on when it comes to making cars that can drive themselves. And then that will lead to the final part of his new master plan, which is having cars that can make money for you rather than you necessarily having to make a payment. Perhaps you simply buy a car, and then when you're not using that car, you have it join a service like Uber or like Lyft and have it be picking up people and dropping them off from work. Because, of course, if your car is driving itself, do you really care if it's sitting there in the parking garage or in your driveway when you're not using it? Or do you just care that it's there when you need it and the rest of the time it's maybe off taking people to work or to the show and making you some money? That's kind of the thought of this new era of car sharing economy, and Musk wants to tap into that in a big, big way.
I have to say that last suggestion makes me laugh. I mean, don't we all know of the neighbor with the expensive car that has a freak out if you chip one like tiny fingernail of paint? I mean, if you've bought your expensive Tesla, are you really going to just let it be driven around by any old person during the day?
It's definitely an interesting proposition for a lot of people. There are a lot of people who love their cars. I know people who won't let their significant others drive their car because they think that they'll do something wrong to it. So the idea that you would have, you know, maybe somebody who had a few too many to drink get in the back of your car and have it take them home, that's something that won't work for everybody. But, you know, the other thing is maybe you have some amount of money that you can afford to spend on a car, and that will get you a certain level of car. Would you be willing to have a car that is twice as expensive and therefore twice as nice if it meant that you have to share it with other people? Not everybody's going to say yes, but a lot of people would say yes. And so if it means getting a better car than you would be able to get otherwise, or indeed having maybe even no car payment at all, that I think is something that will be quite appealing to a lot of people.
So how are other car companies, particularly luxury car companies that are moving into the e-market, you know, one thinks of BMW, Mercedes, GM, of course, you know, how are they all viewing what's going on with Tesla and his gigafactory and his master plan?
All of the other major auto manufacturers are secretly big fans of Tesla. I don't think they would ever admit this publicly, but they are in love with Tesla because Tesla's going out there and really making big strides into this new market and kind of testing the waters for them. Tesla's not necessarily getting a lot of success. You know, they haven't turned a profit yet, but they're figuring out what works. And so all the other manufacturers can kind of sit back and watch and see what happens. And then effectively, once things start to make sense for Tesla, you can kind of tell that all of these other manufacturers are getting ready to jump in the market as soon as that happens. The question is, will Tesla be far enough ahead at that point to stay ahead of them? That remains to be seen.
Tim Stevens, thank you so much for explaining all of this.
My pleasure. Thanks very much for having me.
That was Tim Stevens, editor-in-chief of Roadshow, CNET's auto destination site. I'm Frances Anderton, and this is DNA. Coming up after this break, do Twilight Topor casual piles of La Croix push you to make a purchase? We'll talk to the designer of Whole Foods stores.
Select sessions from KCRW's music program Morning Becomes Eclectic can be experienced in the immersive world of virtual reality. Download KCRW's VR app to get lost in the music. Go to kcrw.com/VR.
Back with DNA, I'm Frances Anderton. And we previously heard about one disruptor. Now let's meet another, albeit in a way that's much more subtle.
I shop for food in grocery stores, and honestly, I didn't like the experience, so I wanted to make them places that I wanted to be in.
Deborah English is an interior designer based in Pasadena who kicked off a career in food retail design with Bristol Farms. That's the Southern California retailer of gourmet, organic, and natural foods. She's spent 15 years working with Whole Foods on all aspects of store planning and design, both in Los Angeles and now nationwide.
I wanted to disrupt the shop because I wanted to find places that would feel good to me to be in as well. And that transfers down to the wider community.
More from Deborah English in a moment. If there's one grocery store that seems to have tapped into the zeitgeist, at least for health-conscious Angelenos, it's Whole Foods. Even though you sometimes read reports about price gouging or lack of worker protections and even food preparation breaches, the stores exert a big attraction to many, at least judging by the lines and crowded parking lots. But why is that? Is it the power of the products? Or could it be the character of the stores themselves? DNA producer Avishai Artsy and I have been thinking about this because we both live close to a Whole Foods. Both were designed by Deborah English and the Whole Foods team, but one is the regular brand at Lincoln & Rose in Venice, and the other is the newly opened lower price version 365 by Whole Foods in Silver Lake, close to Avishai. And it caused a bit of a stir a year ago. Avishai, you reported on that. Tell us about it.
Yes, well, Frances, you might remember about a year ago, there was a bit of a controversy in Silver Lake when Whole Foods announced that their new and highly anticipated Whole Foods would actually be a budget streamlined Whole Foods 365, which is a new brand that they're pushing kind of to appeal to millennials who are maybe looking to spend a little bit less money on their groceries. And there were some members of the Silver Lake community that were quite offended by this and said, hey, you know, we make a good income. We deserve a whole Whole Foods. They started a petition online that didn't do so well. In total, they got about 200 signatures. But that said, it highlighted just how many of us identify ourselves by where we get our groceries. And in the case of Silver Lake, there was a little bit of an identity crisis of, you know, hey, we've come to the point now where we can afford to go to the finer Whole Foods. Why are they trying to sell us this knockoff brand?
Well, now the knockoff brand has arrived and it opened recently. And I know you've been shopping there. How's it being received and how is it?
So for one thing, it's very open. They have huge storefront glass windows letting in light. They also have skylights. And then they have these LED lights that are sort of shaped like blades. You don't see the drop ceiling that you might see in normal stores. Instead, you see the wooden rafters and the, you know, the air ducts and the sprinklers. So it feels like a warehouse, like you could go to a rave there or something. We were at this 365 by Whole Foods, and we talked to Deborah English, and she talked about how the design of the store refers to the values of Silver Lake, which she calls simplicity, efficiency, convenience, and transparency. Now, you might think those are universal values. Don't we all want things to be efficient and convenient and transparent? But she feels like the design of the store refers back to this theme of transparency.
Now, that's going to show up in every single 365 store that you see all across the country. Those pillars or those principles will remain. But what you'll find that's specific to the Silver Lake community are things like the silver kale wall, the selfie wall, if you will, the Instagrammable moment that brings in kind of a play of the value between the Silver Lake community and the natural eating environment.
I hope you like kale, Avishai. And have you taken a selfie against the silver kale wall?
I've yet to do so, but we did make Deborah English pose in front of the silver kale wall. And this is so interesting. I never would have thought that I would take a selfie in my supermarket, and yet people are doing that. And it's because Whole Foods is trying to brand itself really as a destination, as a place that you go, that you socialize, you go with friends, and you get coffee, and maybe you get your groceries at the same time. But it's trying to be more than just a supermarket.
Okay, so now let's go to Whole Foods in Venice, not necessarily distinguished by Instagram moments like the ones you've described, but some other features that perhaps warrant talking about. We should say this is at Rose and Lincoln. It's an area that really brings together the very affluent and actually very poor. There's poor communities in Venice. We've also got a lot of homeless people in that area. It's got a very gritty feel, but it's near the ocean. Deborah English said they wanted to, I guess, kind of reflect all of that. They tried to diffuse any local tensions by bringing in local artists to work on the store. They've gone for a less sort of transparent, more sort of woodsy feel. The place is huge. It's got a kind of a countrified quality. I will say it has fantastic lighting, distinguishing it from supermarkets of the past, kind of warm. Deborah English said they were trying to go for a look that kind of meshed the urban gritty feel with its proximity to the gorgeous blue ocean.
That particular store, we used really pretty deeper, richer colors, but ones that evoke more of an urban landscape. I remember one of the colors in there that we used originally was like this dusty lavender color. And we got a lot of flack for using purple inside of a grocery store. You know, that's not a grocery store color. I mean, how could you use that color? But it ended up as this, I think it was called Twilight Taupe. And they said to me, what are you doing using purple? You can't use purple inside the store. And I said, it's not purple. It's called Twilight Taupe.
Yeah, I mean, just thinking about color choice, for example, when you walk into the one in Silver Lake, you'll notice that they really stick to blue, red, yellow, and then also green. And, you know, she refers to those as very simple colors, not tricky colors, as in they're not confusing or upsetting in any way.
Like us in Venice.
Exactly, yeah.
very tricky.
We can't handle Twilight Taupe in Silver Lake. So everything is very colorful and very kind of buoyant, very, very friendly. But you notice that. You don't think about it, but you do notice it. The thing that Whole Foods really tries to do is reflect the spirit of the community that it's in. And so Deborah English talked about, you know, one specific example that I thought was really fascinating was a Whole Foods that they were getting ready to open in Hawaii.
We went there with this idea that the Hawaiian store should be about the surf and the sun and the sand. And then we got into a room of people that would shop in that store, and we found out exactly the opposite. You know, they wanted respite from the sun. They wanted it to be cool and shady. So we went from laying on the beach and trying to figure it out to heading inland. And we got into the jungle and we started hiking the jungles. And we started looking at all the things that were the materials and the finishes that were dark and shady and comforting instead.
Back to 365, we've talked about openness, we've talked about an industrial feel, but there's another element to that store that was really quite surprising.
Yeah, you know, one thing that Deborah English mentioned to us was the way that, you know, artists helped inspire her aesthetic in retail design. So one person that inspires her is the late artist Dan Flavin, who makes these kind of minimalist art pieces out of fluorescent light fixtures. And she sort of sees that as the inspiration for those LED blades that are on the ceiling. So instead of just kind of conventional fluorescent bulbs, you have very stylized bulbs that bring in a certain warmth of light. The other artist that was very inspirational is Sister Carita Kent, who
Sister
we've talked
Carita
about.
Sister Carita Kent?
Yes, who we've talked about here on DNA. Yes, the nun and political activist, and the graphics and the window transparencies in 365 are totally drawn from Sister Carita Kent. So let's go back to Deborah English and have her explain where this came from.
When we first saw her work in context to 365 was through a branding deck that was done by a firm in New York. And lucky for us, at the very same time, in the Pasadena Art Museum, there was a retrospective of her life's work. So I piled our entire design team into the car. We went down to the museum, and we were deeply inspired and moved by her work and her messages, but her work, and saw how that could relate to 365 by Whole Foods Market, because her words are powerful, but at the same time, they're done in ways that are very accessible.
I have to say, I wonder, no offense, but like what Sister Carita Kent would think, knowing that the style of her art that she used for the messages of peace and social justice are sort of being used in a way to sell groceries.
For me, I think she would be delighted Not only did she use a lot of food imagery in her work, and if you look at it, she took the Wonder bread bag and she turned it into a, you know, a piece on food equality. So Whole Foods has been forefront in the natural food and healthy eating for years and have been in the leading edge of that. And so they carry through a lot of those ideas, the deep values that go along with their product.
I'm sure some might point out that Sister Carita herself did do some work for some corporations. But nonetheless, everything she's just said does make one think about sort of Whole Foods as a corporation, you know, and many of us who shop at Whole Foods are aware that it's not entirely perfect as a corporation.
But these are things that we weigh when we decide where we want to go get our groceries. I mean, there are other grocery stores that are constantly going on strike because of their labor practices. So you're like, okay, well, I don't want to shop there, even though it might be cheaper there. I mean, that's always sort of a balance,
right? It's the constant juggling act. But one of the things that one does fully believe about Whole Foods is that it does represent a departure from the industrialization of food, which begs the question, how much does Whole Foods represent a departure in terms of supermarket design from the early supermarkets that were so different? They were sterile, they were bright white, they have a very unpleasant, cold, fluorescent strip lighting. And I think Deborah English has looked at that.
Traditional grocery stores of the past served us all really, really well. These big white boxes, sanitary boxes, were quite revolutionary if you think about them juxtaposed to the small little local community butcher and florist and produce shop. But now times have changed and we've changed and the consumers are much more sophisticated. The idea of creating a very social space has become incredibly important, particularly to the millennial group, and they want to be able to feel good about the places that they're shopping in. It's like they talk about the third place. It's not the third place anymore. It's a whole new place. It's a whole new way of being so that it becomes a part of your life. Food shopping is such an important thing that we do. Why not let it be delightful? Why does it have to be drudgery?
So Avishai, I think we probably have to wrap by asking you, do you like your new 365 by Whole Foods?
You know, I'm conflicted. There are things that I do like about it. It is convenient. I think the prices are pretty comparable to other grocery chains. There are things that specifically seem to appeal to hipsters or millennials that kind of annoy me. Like when you first walk in, there's this thing that says free air guitars and it's like a rack. Like you borrow your air guitar while you're going shopping. It's very manicured, but in a way to make it look sort of messy. Like there are these stacks of La Croix in the middle of the aisle, like sometimes on pallets that make you think, oh, it's like they haven't finished putting this away. But really it's there because La Croix is so colorful. It's a way to make the store a little bit more exciting, but it also makes it feel sort of like messy, but in a very thought out way.
And is it the thought outness that's bugging you because you're feeling branded too?
Exactly. It's sort of like, I know that they're manipulating me. I sort of like it, but I'm also annoyed by it.
Now, already you've run into a few people.
Oh, yeah. Mimi Zeiger, who's an architecture critic and lives in Silver Lake, and she shops there about once a week and she calls it her guilty pleasure. So I called her and asked her what she thought about the store design.
It's almost as if like an Apple store and like that hippie co-op that you used to go to, like had a left child.
That's a pretty funny observation. Avishai, thank you so much.
Of course. Thanks, Francis. Now I'm on the inside looking at my list. Organic chicken, kale salad, and a lemon twist. Some girl in yoga pants is looking at me funny.
I'm just trying to find a decent Pinot Noir for $120. I'm Francis Anderton. You're listening to DNA. In late July, a fire from a blown transformer in a downtown LA pallet yard spread into the studio of ceramicist Ben Medansky. The flames ripped through his studio, leaving the building structurally unsound and destroying some of Ben's work. Medansky had been scheduled to display his pots and cups and sculptures in a show at the Craft and Folk Art Museum called Clay LA, but the fire meant he couldn't participate. Now he's focused on rebuilding his business and finding a new space with a little help from his friends, who've been supporting him through a GoFundMe site. We caught up with him on his mobile. Ben Medansky, hello.
Hi.
First off, we're so sorry about this calamity. It must have been a real shock.
Yeah, definitely was a huge surprise to be driving downtown and get a call that
my studio might be on fire and that I should head down there. And then to my surprise, I get there and realize it actually, is my studio causing this huge smoke across the city of LA. And the next day I get in there and I realize I finally got that skylight that I always wanted.
But you get your skylight, and what's happened to all your pots?
Most of my work was shattered by the roof caving in, but everything that didn't get destroyed by water or the fire actually I might be able to look at it in a whole new context of beauty. Some of the pieces that I was waiting to glaze were sitting right at the heart of the flame and went through very similar processes that happens in the kiln. So a lot of the pieces I was able to salvage kind of look really beautiful, like they've gone through a raku or wood firing. They just sat there while the flames and the smoke and the soot and everything blew past them, creating a film of black, charcoaly, resiny texture on the outside of them.
So what you're saying, and this is very philosophical of you, but you're saying that your studio became for a moment a sort of a vast kiln.
Exactly. That's exactly what happened.
The fire in your studio was caused by an accidental fire in a neighbouring building. However, the Southland is susceptible to wildfire, and certainly people in the past have lost businesses to fire. A notable person in the design community is the late Tony Duquette, phenomenal decorator and interior designer. He lost mammoth amounts of work twice to fire, but he did so in the time before GoFundMe sites, you know, when one largely relied on insurance, I guess, in situations like this. Do you think that coming out of calamity like this has been perhaps changed with our relationship to social media?
Oh, absolutely. I think insurance is able to help maybe a little bit, but the process to go through insurance is taking forever. And to be able to have a site like GoFundMe where the community is able to interject and help instantly and the money instantly gets deposited into whatever bank account is set up, I'm able to sustain a business in the interim until insurance helps out. I think having things like, you know, I walked into the studio the next day and I turned on my Facebook Live video recording thing just because I had no room on my phone to record a video. So I'm like, oh, I'll do Facebook Live. I didn't realize that 15,000 people are going to be watching this thing right away. And it created such a stir in the community, and all my friends were able to see it and share it, and family across the country. I started getting calls from around the world of people hearing of this and reaching out to see if I needed any support. And having a platform like GoFundMe is so important in today's age.
And psychically too, that feeling of being absolutely gutted, literally gutted by an event like this, is somewhat diffused by the way in which it becomes a kind of community barn building, or a community barn rebuilding experience.
Yeah, having the community so involved didn't really allow me to have room to be too sad or upset. I mean, of course, this was devastating and I cried plenty of times, but the amount of people that have come up to me saying that this might be a blessing or something, not that everything happens for a reason. I really hate that. I think nothing happens for a reason, but everything happens as it should. And somehow something great is going to come out of this.
Can we expect to see your work anytime soon?
Hopefully having a fire sale, pun intended, at LAX Art in the next month or two.
Well, keep us posted and we will direct people to that fire sale when it takes place.
Thank you.
That was Ben Medanski. And that's it for today's DNA. I'm Frances Anderton. Avishai Artsy is the show's producer. Ray Guana mixed this episode. Special thanks to Jason Groman and Stephanie Case. Thank you very much for listening.